Hi, I'm William Tullett from Anglia Ruskin University in Cambridge.
And I'm Hannah McCann from the University of Melbourne in Australia.
And welcome to the Pandemic Sensory Archive, a collection of voices from sensory experts on the fate of the five senses during and after the COVID-19 pandemic.
This project has been sponsored by the British Academy, and we hope that you enjoy the interview.
Hello and welcome back to the Pandemic Sensory Archive. Today I'm joined by Susan Boyle. And so I'm just going to start by asking you, Susan, if you can just introduce who you are, what you do, and kind of what your expertise is when it comes to the senses.
Sure. My name is Susan Boyle. I'm a PhD candidate at TU Dublin, which is Technological University of Dublin. I'm looking at beverages, and I'm particularly interested in smells and tastes and how they can how they relate to drinks. Specifically looking at alcoholic drinks, so that's beer, wine and spirits. And then I also work as an international beverage judge, so I judge the World Beer Awards. I make beer, and I am working with the Irish Food Board on a whiskey project where I'm using scent as a kind of almost like scent as a storyteller that can lead people through the processes of distillation and the products of distillation as well.
So. Fantastic. I mean, so before the pandemic, then, sort of, how would you use your senses? You know, your senses in your work. How did you use your sense of taste and smell?
So I've always used taste as a way of learning, particularly when I started my own journey learning about wines. I was always led by understanding what was inside my glass through tasting, and then would always use taste as the primary way of understanding that wine, and then supporting that with the knowledge that you can find out about the wine. So understanding why a thing tastes the way because of where it's grown or who made it, but tasting being the driving force first. And then smell, obviously, as kind of a support as well. So the two are very much intertwined, smell and taste. But it's the way I like to learn. So in relation to the work that I do, I'm fascinated by how when you have the story of where a drink comes from or who has made it, how that becomes more real and more embodied for the person who's learning about that when you account for taste and smell in relation to it. And I've just always been fascinated by how things taste and how things smell. So it's been a lovely way of learning about drinks, and it's a way in my research that I want to capture so that other people can use it as more of a mode to learn about the things that they find in their glasses.
Yeah, so do you think that the pandemic then has, you know, what's your experience been of the pandemic and working with taste and smell during the pandemic? Do you think it's presented particular challenges for the kinds of work you do, whether that's your research or your work with the Irish Food Board or kind of the tasting and smelling in terms of competitions and awards and things?
Yeah, there's been a couple of things that have happened. So when I started working on the spirits project for the Irish Food Board, I was very insistent of wanting to have these sensory elements as part of the education program. So it's it's going to be a global education program around Irish spirits. And it's interesting because when the pandemic happened, like, we always kind of knew, we're like, oh, we'll do a tasting or whatever. Like, that's definitely going to happen. Like, everyone in the team was very much on board with that. But I wanted to push that further into the realm of smell, and also into looking at other things that you can taste besides the spirits themselves. So, like, actually tasting the kind of primary flavor elements within those spirits and understanding where they come from. And as soon as the pandemic happened, everyone was very much more on board with that, which is interesting because I think there was a heightened awareness of the importance of smell and taste in light of the anosmia that that was appearing as an effect of having COVID-19. So I think it very clearly put into the picture the, like, life without smelling and tasting became something that was a real prospect for people. So within that project specifically, people were more valued it more, which was interesting because before it, the conversations about the structure of the project had been very text-based. It's like, what are you going to say around this area when we address this? And now it was more like, well, what are people going to be smelling or tasting while this aspect of the program is happening, while you're facilitating that? So I think that was a very interesting shift. And then also, in relation to tasting sides of things, I decided to set up with my sister, we hosted online tastings because I was just so, what I realized personally was that for me, separating how something tastes and smells from where you are or the people you're with provides these huge challenges, because something will taste and smell better or different depending on the people you are with and the context in which you are consuming that drink. And I thought that was really interesting because like I've got like, you know, a cupboard full of delicious things that I can drink at home here in my own house. But you know what, William, they just weren't as delicious. And it really struck me. So having talked it over with my sister, we decided to set up an online virtual wine club that we ran from her wine shop. And we would post blind tastings to people who would then log on and taste these drinks with us. And the experience was just so much more interesting and enriching than I really even thought it could be, because I'd been very, I suppose, very attached to the idea that when you're doing a wine tasting or a drinks tasting, you need to be in the same physical room as the people you're tasting with. And then I kind of had this epiphany doing these virtual tastings that actually you don't, but you need to be tasting the same thing. And that thing that you're tasting becomes the connection for the group of people and becomes the focus. And it was really lovely because the community that grew up around these tastings, like it was just so nice to see people who didn't know each other, who were sitting in different parts of the country, chatting to each other. And because there's that kind of Proustian aspect of smell and taste where it can throw people to other places from their past, it became these really lovely sessions where people were really open and really shared a lot of their own personal experiences in this very intimate way. And I know part of that is because we're zooming into people's homes and people's spaces, but I hadn't considered how taste became the gateway and allowed people to share their personal experiences, and it grounded the experiences that they were sharing for essentially a group of strangers who were like, you know, logging on at like 7:30 to drink wine together. Like it was amazing.
I mean, that's fantastic. It's really interesting. So you know, there's a way in which you know, anosmia and smell and taste loss in the context of the pandemic has actually paradoxically led people to kind of be more interested in and more attentive to and more focused on smell and taste. But also, there's a really interesting example there of the tasting, of the way in which, you know, by kind of isolating taste in a sense from the other senses, by kind of focusing on taste, I suppose, more as a result of doing these things via Zoom, it seems like people almost were able to access more idiosyncratic and individual relationships with what they were tasting than perhaps they would have done if they were doing it in the same place.
I definitely think so, because I think there's something that happens when you're tasting with groups of people. Ideas are just so contagious. So, you know, I smell something and the minute I say what it reminds me of, then immediately I've muddied the waters for everyone else. Because if I say grapefruit and I'm the person leading that experience, everyone is going to start looking to smell or taste grapefruit. Mm-hmm. So then they'll find it. Because especially with something like wine, where, and wine is different to beer when you taste it, but with wine you only have grape juice in your glass. Like that's it. It's just grapes. You know, there are no peaches or watermelon or cherries. It's grapes. So the words that we use to describe smells and tastes are related to things that are not there. So then we're tasting in a virtual space where we're not there, but we are there. And there's just this weird play in my head about how really perfect a virtual space, a connected virtual space is for tasting, because it mimics what we have in the glass, which is, you know, which is grape juice, but not grape juice because it smells and tastes of all these other things. So we're together and connected, but not connected because we're all in our own individual homes. And that is a kind of a very overarching concept, is something that that has definitely intrigued me in relation to this, looking for what are those connections in these mediatized virtual spaces, and how food and drink, and I think more drink, because I've done some food things and they haven't been as, or have participated in them, they haven't been as enjoyable or successful. I think because people get caught up in the doing and the making of a thing. And this also leads to the whole, the Instagramification of food. I did quite a bit of work on Irish television with drinks tastings, and it was work I wanted to do more of, but I would always get this feedback from the producers of the program, which is, at the end of the day, Susan's just liquid in a glass, like, why should we care about this? Well, food looks amazing. And what I'm really interested in is that swing back to an appreciation of the non-visual senses. And I think there's been more of that happening in the pandemic, or at least maybe because I'm attuned to it, so I can't be objective about this at all, but, and maybe I've sought it out, but I've definitely seen a move away from things just looking beautiful on Instagram to, you know, experiences where you can connect through smell and taste in a virtual space. And I think it's fascinating.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? I suppose one other example of that is one of our other interviewees mentioned kind of bread making, you know, which obviously was a really big thing during the pandemic, people making sourdough bread in particular. And there's a way in which, you know, the baking of bread really brings in smell and kind of tactility and touch as well. And it's a much more multi-sensory experience of food than just posting something on Instagram. And of course, actually, often the bread can look quite visually appealing, but sometimes it can taste great, but not look particularly visually appealing. It can look a bit lumpy and burnt, and that's a really interesting transformation. And do you think therefore that the pandemic has transformed our relationship with our senses in a meaningful way? Do you think some of these changes will kind of lead to long-term shifts in the way, you know, we sense food and drink? Or do you think that this is kind of a moment that will kind of disappear and we'll go back to that kind of visual Instagramification of our food culture?
I just don't know. And it's like, so if I'm optimistic, I would be like, yes, of course, this is going to be an enormous change. But I'm really not sure, because I'm also very keenly aware that there's lots of people where taste and smell just isn't significant for them at all. And we know this because there's advertising, you know, so, you know, and we know this because there's certain wines that have enormous, enormous cachet and have cultural capital. And I think about that kind of the use of consumables of food and drink as being, commodified, and because so much of that is beyond nutrition. It's not about consuming something for its nutritional value or for its shared value in relation to kind of solidifying groups of people together. It's just about showing off what restaurant you're in and that you can afford to spend so much on wine. I wonder. I would hope that there is a change. There are some areas where I do see some practical changes. So in relation to the Irish craft beer industry, it has been somewhat of a struggle in the last number of years for small breweries to get spaces on bars to sell their beer. There's been just that kind of, I suppose, bar real estate has been dominated by a number of macro brands. And during the pandemic, there was such a switch to people consuming beers at home rather than in bar spaces that the people who were drinking beer were not influenced by what taps were on the bar when they went up to order a pint. Instead, they were sitting at home in their own houses, looking through lists online and ordering it to have it delivered to their own house. And there were a number of very swift, fast adapting craft breweries that had full licenses who were in a position to be able to set up online off licenses. And they worked with a number of other breweries. It was sometimes in these small industry communities that can be hard to see examples of people working together, but in this situation they worked really well. And it was interesting talking to the brewers about how much more of their beer they were selling. Like, none of them were telling me they were making any more money, because they wouldn't. So they were all like, you know, well, we're working three times as hard, Susan, we're definitely not making any more money. But you know what? We're selling beer to different people and interesting people, and people are seeking out those beers and having it delivered to their homes. And I think that that's going to change. So I think people will want those beers when they start to go back into pubs. Like today is the first day that we're open for indoor drinking and dining. So it's quite interesting that we're doing this interview on the 26th of July, because it's the first day. Like, there's pubs that just haven't been open for, like, you know, some opened at Christmas for a small amount of time, but lots of people just haven't been open at all. So I wonder what it's going to be like when these people, these drink and beer lovers who've been at home being able to support local breweries and drink delicious things, and they're going back into pubs and they're not seeing those options. I think that will be interesting, or at least I hope it will.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think it will be interesting. I suppose the kind of mention of people ordering lots of, you know, exciting and interesting craft beers to their home kind of brings up this theme, which has been common in lots of the news reporting around the lockdown, in particular during the pandemic, which is that alcohol consumption has, you know, risen during the pandemic. And obviously, particularly alcohol consumption at home, because people have been stuck at home, but more generally, people are just consuming more alcohol. You know, do you think that's a trend that you've kind of recognized? And do you think it's a trend that will continue, or was just a kind of associated with lockdown?
Yeah, so I definitely know, like, so people are consuming more alcohol at home, people are buying more alcohol in supermarkets, but I have yet to find evidence that actually proves that people overall are drinking more. So while there are numbers where definitely it has increased, like, because the sales in supermarkets have, but because, like, pubs and restaurants have been closed, I actually don't think, and I think when I look at, like, the Exchequer revenue, is definitely down for alcohol sales. Interestingly enough, it's up for cigarettes. So there's definitely more people smoking, way more people smoking in Ireland anyway. I'm not so sure anywhere else. But overall, alcohol hasn't increased in relation to. Now, you see, the thing is that you don't even, like, it's such a grey area. Just because you buy a bottle of wine, does that mean you drink it there and then? You know, so I do think that those numbers need to be pulled out, because I definitely think there was, like, here anyway, there was, like, a public health campaign, which was like, if you find you're drinking more. And I don't know if that was just because people thought people might drink more in a pandemic. On a personal level, my alcohol consumption has dramatically decreased. And most people I know, their alcohol consumption has decreased, partly because the places and spaces that we would have consumed alcohol were not at our disposal. So I think it's interesting. I think further research needs to be done on that, because I see a lot of like newspaper headlines and warnings on the radio about alcohol consumption in a pandemic. But I query whether those numbers are actually ringing through.
Yeah, it's really interesting, isn't it? I mean, in some ways, you could argue that this is, as you say, a kind of product of the statistics that, and there's a kind of misleading element to them, in the sense that, you know, if you go to a pub, if you go to a restaurant and you buy a drink, the likelihood is you are going to drink it there and then. Whereas, as you say, if you go to a supermarket and buy a bottle of wine, there's no guarantee that you'll drink it. You might save it and then, you know, be forced to bring it to somebody else's when you go there for dinner, as kind of hope. I suppose. That, you know, that's something that hopefully we'll be able to kind of examine more in the future and kind of understand the impact of. I suppose the other thing here is it's the product of a kind of general instinctual thing we have where we tend to see alcohol as somehow a crutch during times of stress, right? And that's clearly not always the case. There are lots of other ways in which people relate to their consumption of alcohol that go far beyond that.
Yeah, I think so. And I do think that it becomes a way of thinking that there's, you know, alcohol is a controlled substance and it needs to be a controlled substance. And it is a substance that causes a lot of harm to a considerable number of people. How do I put a but even after that sentence? Because that's just the truth. I think, though, that it's more complex. And I think our relationships with alcohol and kind of modeling a consumption of alcohol that is not as harmful is kind of maybe an important conversation that needs to be had. Like if you think of other European countries where even things like wine in France or beer in Germany is seen as an agricultural product, that the link between where the product comes from and the ingredients that go into making it are like more grounded in agriculture than they are in this kind of aspirational high shelf treat thing. I think that that's a different way of considering alcohol and maybe a more holistic way, a way that's more connected to the people who make it, where it grows, those kind of aspects of it. But like, you know, I live on an island where we don't commercially grow grapes, so I'm not gonna meet a grape farmer any day soon, you know. So of course the connection between it being something that's of the land and of the people becomes separated. So then it becomes something that is dangerous or has danger associated with it, and you know, is something just for taxing and generating revenue out of. So it's I think it's an interesting thing to consider where alcohol sits, and that, and always that balance between I suppose harm and, you know, consuming it in the least harmful way.
And so do you think then that, you know, we've talked about some of the changes that have happened during the pandemic and, you know, some of the kind of shifting attitudes and perhaps some of those changes were not changes at all. The example of alcohol consumption and its kind of rise or fall being one. Do you think that, you know, what will the future be of our sensory relationship with food and drink in a post-pandemic world? Do you think it will look different, our kind of sensory relationship in particular to alcohol?
I really don't know. I think the pandemic has been such a huge thing, and such a thing that we have experienced, like everyone has been touched by it, that I can't see how it couldn't affect something that's so fundamental like what we eat and drink. And even if it's something on a really basic level, we've become more aware of the potential for not being able to get what we want either. And I think that's been compounded a little bit by other things like the Suez Canal blockage and by Brexit. So there's other things. But I think for the first time in a lot of people's lifetimes, they had to think about what would happen if they couldn't get what they wanted. Now, food shortages hasn't necessarily been a huge problem, but it's definitely been, I think, more in people's minds. So I wonder if that will make people just more considered and mindful. And I think people have to have been put in a position where they've had to think more about the unconscious choices that they used to make around alcohol and food. So, you know, oh, I just eat this because that's what I eat when I always go there, or I'm buying the same drink when I go to the same pub all the time out of habit. So those habits have been broken. So whenever that happens, there's space for people to re-examine the patterns of behavior that they used to do. So I'm hoping that provides an opportunity. I'm sure there's lots of people who just go back to doing exactly what they've always been doing. But I think for other people, I think there have been changes and questions, and I know, and like even just on an anecdotal and personal level, I'm so much more driven by taste than I think I ever was before. Like I just want things to be delicious. Like there's just no point in eating for the sake of eating. I kind of did this complete reverse in relation to comfort food. My comfort food became things that were just so delicious, and even if they were just a tiny bit undelicious, I was like, I'm not bothering eating that, you know. I was pretty choosy to begin with, but I became very selective, and I like that. And in the couple of restaurants that I've visited since, you know, the restrictions have changed a little bit here, disappointment is has been a big part of my experience, and I can't work that out in my head yet, if that's just because I've built up the idea of going somewhere to eat where someone else does the washing up for you to this unattainable level. I don't know if my brain has just decided that that's amazing and then it's not actually as amazing in reality, or if it is that the food is not quite as good as what I can make at home or I can drink at home. It's I think it's quite it's interesting. So I definitely think yes, there is a change, there will be a change. As to what that is or for how long it will last, I'm not totally sure.
So that's a fascinating note to end on, I think, because that gap between sensory expectation and reality when it comes to going back to eating out, you know, in some way relates to this earlier point that you were making about how, you know, tastings, for example, conducted via Zoom have kind of transformed people's relationship to the products. You know, the spaces in which we eat and drink clearly have a really important effect on how we taste and smell and engage with our food. And so it will be interesting to see whether, you know, other people share that kind of sense of disappointment when they reemerge back into restaurants and spaces, or whether it will just change how they taste and eat and drink in public.
Yeah, I think like even from it took me when the pandemic happened, I had this who in academia doesn't have a crisis about is their work relevant? But my work was all about immersive sensory experiences with alcohol, and that's what I was really focused on. And I was like, well, they're not happening anymore. How do I get over this? And it took me a good long time to kind of wrap my head around it. And these conversations, what we've been covering in this conversation, really links to my original academic background is in drama and theatre studies. So I've always been fascinated by the live and shared events that are framed in time and space. From, I suppose, a theatrical perspective, that's what happens in theatre spaces. And the way that I'm approaching these sensory experiences is through performance analysis, because I think it's the most complete way of being able to account for the extrasensory elements. So the mise-en-scene, the setting, and then also the narrative elements and the storytelling elements, like the text and the words and the performers and the interplay between the space and the audience and the performers and the lines that are blurred between an audience member that then is consuming and participating. And theatre provides loads of lovely models around that in relation to participatory theatre and site-specific theatre. And it's taken me almost the duration of the pandemic, or maybe a little less, thankfully, to understand. Because a lot of the work that I was doing was justifying why I was looking at drinks through this theatrical lens. And it has just settled and made so much more sense during the pandemic. I think it's almost like that feeling that if you have something cut off or not available to you, then you really focus on how things function or why things work together. So not being able to just continue the research I was doing about immersive events and having to really consider those and the elements that are involved in them, I think has made my hypothesis and for the use of theatre as a lens in these situations much stronger, I hope. She says.
Yeah, well, Well, we will see. And I really look forward to kind of hearing more about your work in the future, Susan. I think there's a sense in which I think the pandemic maybe has also highlighted, because we've been based on Zoom, we've been based, you know, using kind of online technologies. There's a sense for people of this kind of gap between what they consider the virtual and what they consider the real, you know, and smell and taste being intimately bound up with the real side of that binary. So it'll be really interesting to see what happens next with that. But thank you so much, Susan. It's been an absolutely fascinating discussion, and I look forward to seeing where your research goes next.
Thank you so much.